come on.
There we go.
Perfect.
Yeah.
That's a weird sound.
That's exciting.
Is that okay?
Oh, no, is your volume on?
Oh, right. Hang on, I can do some things in here. That remote doesn't seem to work. I suspect the batteries are dead. I think if we had two replacement batteries for the handset, then we could solve this problem by using that HDMI cable. But I think that the problem is
what sort of batteries do you make?
Those are double A's.
Yeah. He's trying. I can do without the roof.
Switch it over. Let's see if my hypothesis was correct. Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that, guys. Should we get out of the way? Thank you very, very much for coming along to this extramural compass seminar, the first for the year. We've got a great turnout to hear an international speaker, Professor Kenneth Benoit, who's a Professor of Computational Social Science in the Department of Methodology at LSE in the UK. He's also a principal investigator in the creation of the Quantata initiative. That's quantitative analysis of textual data, and that produced the Quantata R package that presumably can do some of this analysis. Ken spent nearly two decades working on text analytics in the political science and other areas, and it's an area I have to say I know very little about, but I'm keen to learn more about. The area that I'm particularly interested in is in the sort of health sphere, where primary healthcare data is often collected by GPs who don't stick nicely to the boxes that are given to them, in sort of a text way, and there needs to be a way to analyse that and get some good clinical information from primary care data. Anyway, I think we've got most of our tech problems sorted. Just as we change the batteries.
Doing a little hacking here.
Can I just add, this is a Compass seminar jointly with the Public Policy Institute, so it's our inaugural seminar of the year as well.
True.
And we're having a few drinks to celebrate Ken's arrival and so on after the seminar. I don't think we catered for 100, which we have here, but come up and join us, and if you can scramble some food and drink, that would be great.
And so that's up just opposite the Owen Glen, but you can just follow the trail of people getting that way afterwards. Sarah, I'll pass over to Kenneth now to hear about the 10 most important things that he's learned about quantitative text analysis.
Thanks very much. Yes, I'm going to, and I'm very flattered that all of you turned out. I realize this is the middle of the summer and the holidays, and this was kind of quickly organized, so thanks for showing up, and I'll try to make it worth your while. I'm going to talk somewhere around 45 minutes, maybe a little bit over. If we have questions, you're free to ask me questions at any time. Conceptually speaking, this is a very, very simple thing to get your head around. The organization of my talk, I'm going to go through 10 things that I've learned about quantitative text analysis. I'll give you a little bit more background, but part of that background is part of the talk. I'm a professor of computational social science in a very unusual interdisciplinary department that is called Department of Methodology at the London School of Economics. And what we do is basically teach people how to do research using methods that, not just quantitative methods, but also qualitative methods and also computational methods, what we call data science. We teach that to pretty much everyone in the school except the economists. And the economists only talk to themselves, so we don't try to. That's an area we're not involved in. But. Right. So, and quantitative text analysis is a field I've been working in for I don't know, at least 15 years now. I like to say I was doing it before it became cool, at least in my field of political science. Doing it before we had any sophistication in this field at all. It's become a very sophisticated field in social sciences, but especially in political science, for the simple reason in political science that we have some of the most important things in political science we can't observe directly. Preferences, ideology, intent. These are important inner states of minds that if we had a magical scanning device to read people's brain waves, we could just directly record information on that. We have no such device yet. We have basically the observable implications of that inner state of mind in the form of what people say. And of course, increasingly, this wasn't true when I started doing this 15 years ago. We have people's behavior as recorded by the next best thing to their brain, which is that little device that everyone carries around that used to be used for making telephone calls, but now is used for recording all of the rest of your behavior voluntarily and involuntarily. How many of you do some form of quantitative text analysis? Or any form of text analysis? Systematic, like, okay. How many of you have done this using the software tools that I've developed, this Quantita product? Anyone familiar with that? How many of you are familiar with the R programming language? You should be, because it started here, right? You'd be very, very proud to know it started here. Right, okay, so this is not anything technical, but I am going to show you a few things that you can take away as a bit of a brief demonstration, but they're illustrations rather than really demonstrations. So if you're hungry to know more about this, at the end of the talk I'll be showing you some resources where you can read more about how to unlock this amazing world of quantitative text analysis using some of the tools that I've developed. Right, so let's start with the first most important thing. The first most important thing is to not forget that text is a fundamentally qualitative type of data. The stuff that I'm concerned with is primarily about converting this into quantitative information, but it is fundamentally qualitative in nature. Let me show you what I think is the basic diagram or the basic schematic of the process of doing quantitative text analysis that I think sort of demystifies the process. And I've got this into three stages here. So pretend that I know how to use Google Presentation in a more sophisticated fashion. I could build up these three vertical sections in stages. I don't know that yet. But if you pretended that and just looked at the first one, we start with what are raw texts. Now, as a demonstration, I use freely available texts, which are the inaugural speeches of U.S. presidents, because these are copyright free and they're available online. I don't use State of the Union addresses because, you know, they may not be delivered each year. And there's a lot more of them. So inaugural addresses, there are, I think, 58 of them. There are 58 inaugurations of U.S. presidents. Some people are in there twice. Some people you hope won't be in there twice. I try to restrain myself. So the raw text, these are just snippets of some of the beginnings of the inaugural addresses. Now, if you look at that raw data on the left-hand side, you can read that, you can figure out what's being said. Why? Because you speak that language, and this is the language, at least if you're native, this is the structure in which you think. This is how we communicate, both intrapersonally and sort of internally, through language. We structure our very thoughts through language. If you've learned other languages, I'm sure many of you do speak other languages, you know that you can even have different thoughts when those concepts become accessible through explaining something in another language. So what do we do with this wonderful, nuanced, rhetorical, poetic, possibly literary source of structuring our thoughts? What we do is we put it into the computerized equivalent of a hamburger grinder, right? And we crank it through there, we process it. When we process it, we end up with something that looks a lot like this. We get a matrix format. Now, one of the attributes of a matrix format is that there's no order with rows. There's no order with columns. They're all interchangeable. And in this matrix here, what we're doing is we're counting in rows the documents. Well, we've got rows as documents, and we've got columns as the features, or what we call the terms, you know, whatever you want to consider a term. And we have converted this into a matrix of the counts of those terms by document. Now, that is hardly... Now, if you want to look at something amazing, and earlier this week was the national holiday in the United States of Martin Luther King Day, and Martin Luther King had some amazing political speeches, some of the most amazing in U.S. political history. If you take the I Have a Dream speech and you process it through this, it's a tragedy to do that if you want to appreciate that piece of political text. But if you want to do this for, say, 10,000 texts and do broad-based comparisons of similarities or clustering or machine learning, you don't have any choice. You have to do this step. So to make text useful, we put it through this meat grinder, and suddenly it's useful, but we've lost all of the amazing things from the source data, and we've lost our ability to make sense of that data in its original form. But then we have access to column number 3, which are all the wonderful things that we can do with a matrix using quantitative tools. In other words, to turn this text into data that we can analyze using quantitative methods, we have to go through this step, but then we have access to all of the arsenal of statistical methods. We can do statistics on these. We can calculate the keyness of terms to figure out which are associated with one subset of our corpus versus another. We can compute readability. We can compute lexical diversity. We can do measures of similarity and distance for clustering applications. We can run machine learning models, either supervised machine learning or unsupervised machine learning. We can use scaling applications to measurement-type models to compare text on some dimension of difference. We can perform these new methods known as word embeddings. We can extract themes in the form of topic models. We can also do a variety of visualizations that need this information to have been converted into some sort of semi-quantitative or quantitative form. We can't do any of these from the raw text. We have to go through some processing step. So the interesting thing for me about text is that it's qualitative in its original form. And to make it interesting, we have to destroy that by making it quantitative. And in a sense, this is the opposite of what we do with our typical, say, econometric data or quantitative data that we have in other types of data sets. We typically start with you do a survey, social survey, someone gives you a spreadsheet. What's the spreadsheet full of? It's full of numbers. Can you look at that raw data and make sense of it? Well, okay, you could find, you know, this row, this column, you could say that's a 4, that's 4% inflation, but you can't look at the series of 4s, 5, 6, 7, whatever, and really make sense of that. In its raw form, we're not good at making sense of collections of numbers. We're great at making sense of collections of words, assuming that they're ordered into sentences and things that make sense. So we go from something we can interpret directly to something that we can't to make it useful with text. With non-text, we do the opposite. We go with something that we can't make sense of directly, and only by synthesizing it can we really make sense of it. That's a reversal of the normal process of data analysis that fascinates me anyway. And it's you know, it's important to understand the context of words. So here I'm showing you some R code, but I'll leave these, I'll make these slides available later. But essentially what we're doing is we've got a corpus of speeches made in a budget debate. We've partitioned those speeches into whether the speech maker was a member of the government party, government coalition, or a member of an opposition party. And then we can essentially construct a 2x2 table for the frequencies of each word to figure out whether they were associated with being a member of the government or opposition due to chance or through some pattern. And we can reject that null hypothesis using a very simple association measure known as chi-squared. And using my software, we can then get an ordered list of the words and their chi-squared statistics, which gives us a measure of the departure from occurrence by chance and their association with a certain side. And what this shows, for example, is that the word Christmas was the number one associated opposition word. If you wanted to perform machine learning to do prediction, which is what people in machine learning do, and you wanted to predict, is this speech an opposition or a government speech, the word Christmas would come up as the most opposition word. So when I say text is qualitative, how do we make sense of that finding? Christmas, opposition word? Well, that, how do you make sense? Well, you make sense by going back to the qualitative source, which gives you what's called a keyword in context, or in this formulation, we call this a concordance, and the concordance gives us the word in context where we can see the other words around it, which means that we can now go back to its format where we can make sense of it. We can read this. And you can see that these are all opposition. Well, you don't know that because unless you know Irish politics, but these are all opposition party speakers, and they're talking about Christmas in the sense that this government had to pass this budget in December, which is the end of the year in the Irish political cycle, and the government had to cut $4 billion in spending because this was the austerity budget of 2009, and the opposition is getting up and saying, you know, all these cuts, you're going to ruin everyone's Christmas. So in attacking the budget, they kept pointing out it was Christmas. The government didn't really want to draw attention to the fact that Christmas was around the corner and you're taking things away from people before Christmas. Christmas is the time when you give people things, not take them away, and then suddenly it makes sense. Going back to context in text is very important because in this process of the hamburger grinder, you lose that context, and if you want to make sense of your results, it's important to be able to go back to the source and doing a lot of the interpretation. Okay, that was a lot on the first point. Not every point is going to take as long. Second, unsupervised methods should be used with great caution. I do a lot of unsupervised machine learning, but as I tell my students in data science, unsupervised machine learning is a little bit like unsupervised children. You might get away with it, but if your children were like mine, it could be a disaster. And they're running off running around doing things that you might not want them to do or that you might have told them not to do or hope that they wouldn't do. Let me give you an illustration. How many of you have heard in political science of this model called the Wordfish scaling model? No? Okay, so it's how many of you have heard of principal components analysis or factor analysis? It's like that, but it's a parametric model using Poisson counts for word occurrence. The idea is that you can feed it a bunch of documents, and based on the patterns of the words, it'll give you on a single dimension of difference, which is like the first dimension of principal components, it'll give you a score where you can place the different text on a single dimension of difference. Now, it's a dimension of difference based on word frequencies. This model knows absolutely nothing about language. You could feed it any matrix and get a similar thing. So what this code here does is it runs from my software this thing called Text Model Wordfish, and there's two versions of it. One of them is the version on everything, and I've written an article about this, so this is from a published application, which you can refer to from my webpage if you want to find it. It's posted there. But I wrote this paper with a guy named Will Lowe. We did this for 14 budget speeches, and it very nicely recovers the positions of the government speakers and the opposition speakers using this model. We were attempting to validate this model using some human coders. And I thought, well, what happens if I take a speech that's totally out of the context? Not totally, so it's still a political speech or a political document. So what did I do? I took the inaugural address from James Adams, U.S. President, delivered in 1797. James Adams was one of the most overeducated and pompous of U.S. presidents, and the way that he spoke and the length of the sentences he used, just think, one end, you've got James Adams, where you need like two PhDs to understand what he's saying, and then you've got, say, when someone like Donald Trump over here speaks like the Dr. Seuss Cat in the Hat, and on the spectrum of sophistication of language, you've got a complete difference. You know, this is one extreme. So we took, and he's talking about it, obviously, he's talking about very different things in 1797. Well, this is the scale, this is the scaling results of the model where we just feed in the normal text without polluting it. What we see, so these two were the government parties, Fianna Fáil and Greens, these are the government parties. They're on the axis, which is perfectly divided for, if you were to draw a line through zero, you'd get a perfect, I can touch the screen, it's okay, yeah. You get a perfect division of government and opposition, and everyone to the left are the opposition parties. And if you know something about Irish politics, as we wrote in the article, this really makes sense. And this is running the model in an unsupervised fashion. In this case, it was fine. What happens if we throw in James Adams' speech? Well, this is simply scaling, remember, difference. James Adams should be as different as possible from the rest of these speeches. And when you throw that in, and here's James Adams down here, we don't know what party he belongs to. Well, he shows up as more opposition than the most anti-government opposition speaker possible. He's at the very far left of the spectrum. Does that make sense in substantive terms? No. But this is a model. It's like throwing in, you know, a variable that has absolutely nothing to do with your analysis into a regression. The computer will give you some estimate on that variable, but it won't mean anything. It's really easy to overlook these facts when you're doing unsupervised machine learning because the tools seem so sophisticated. But you know, if you throw, you know, here we are making an absolutely, you know, wonderful batch of cookies, and then someone threw some sauerkraut into it, and the result turns out is not really to our taste. But hey, the bread machine and cookie machine just went ahead anyway. So we have to be really careful about stuff like that. How many of you have heard of bag of words? This is an approach in linguistics or computational linguistics where bag of words is the step two of my three-step process of quantitative text analysis. We take all the words and we chop them out of their context by tokenizing them. We consider each word in isolation and we put it into a bag. And of course that bag is a bag of unsorted words. Text consists of bags of unsorted words. Well, this is useful, but it's a fiction. And I want to emphasize how fictional this can be. So here's one of my favorite words from the German language. I'm told that this word has been retired, actually. But this is the word here. In German, it's wonderful, because instead of like having a paragraph, you just take all the words in the paragraph and create one word from it. Anyone speak German here? I know you do. No? Any Germans? Speak German? Can you pronounce that? I think we might even have an audio pronunciation, but we don't. No, it means the law concerning the delegation of duties for the supervision of cattle marking and the labeling of beef. What a wonderful word. This comes from a language known as compounding. So in English, if you were to make a bag of words from this long phrase, you would get, you know, words like beef. So you might know that this document had something to do with beef, but the particular nuance from this word would be lost. It would be chopped up among other words. Well, it turns out that there are a lot of these things in the context of what we call domain-specific language. Domain-specific language is typically what we analyze in social science. Economic words, political words, legal words especially, come in what we call multi-word expressions. And if you disassociate the words from their multi-word expression, you lose their nuance. For example, and this is just a list from a paper I'm slowly working on, most tax words need at least two words in English. Income tax, capital gains tax, that's three words. Value-added tax, or general sales tax, as you call it here, is three words. In German, of course, you would just have one long word to show you the difference. And the association of the word tax from these things wouldn't be necessarily in the same ideological direction, because some of these taxes are favored by the left and some of them are favored by the right. So if we only put the word tax into our bag of words, we would not be correctly measuring its orientation, at least in a political sense or a political science sense. So we need to take, we need some models that consider that some words are not the same as other words. Well, of course, we have an app for that. So if we were to run in my software this function called text.colocations, it uses a log linear model detection to come up with a Z score, a normalized score, where the larger this is, the less likely this pair is to have occurred by chance. It's essentially looking at the occurrence of every word followed by every other word and finding the pairs of words that occur greater than chance. With a little bit of filtering, we can extract multi-word expressions, and here we have things like labor party. That's different from the word labor, as in, you know, labor union, labor party. Those are different things. Labor union and labor party in German would just be one word. And in correct text analysis, we don't want to chop those up. We would like to keep it as one word. Child benefit, child care, that sort of thing. And in this case, where we could do this for multi, we can do this for three words. There's no limit to the sequence of words we can do in the software. So family income supplement, for example, a universal social charge, that's a specific governmental tax that really is a single word and should be treated as that. And the way that we do that in Quantita is we can extract those, and then we can use tokens compound to find the multi-word occurrences that we've detected in the text, and it will go ahead and it will convert those into single words. So then we are basically doing what the Germans would have done at the German Language Institute. They would have found all the multi-word expressions and smashed them together to make one giant word. And then we're basically doing, for our text analysis in languages that aren't compounding, what they would be like if they were. Four. So anyone, X-Files fan? Remember the X-Files? They'd start the thing, trust no one. This is really weird, because I'm asking you, I'm trying to sell you on some free software, so you should trust my software, but I'm telling you, don't trust anyone. I'm going to explain to you the paradox of this, and why I say, especially don't trust yourself. So, I'm going to give you an illustration. Has anyone heard of Naive Bayes supervised classifier? So, it's a very simple probabilistic classifier. And the way that supervised machine learning works is you give it an example. Like I say, here are pictures. These are a bunch of pictures of cats. These are a bunch of pictures of dogs. We will train the system and it'll recognize. For images, it's more complicated than text, but you basically do have to have a, you have to break up the images into their elements, and then it'll have a collection of elements. It'll associate some with dogs and some with cats, and then when it finds a new picture, it breaks it into elements and then takes the probabilities from those elements from the original training set, projects that onto the new document, comes up with a probability of being a dog versus a cat. And we can, I wanted to do this for text. So here, what we're going to do is we're going to take these parties, these are the documents from the 2010 political manifestos of the United Kingdom and the sections of their manifestos that spoke about immigration. And we're going to try to predict which ones are anti-immigration and which ones are sort of pro or neutral in immigration. So I'm going to take these documents and I'm going to create a document feature matrix. In other words, this command DFM converts that into the matrix, one simple command. And this is an R package. I searched everywhere in the R package, you know, among the, what is it now, like 13, 14,000 R packages, maybe it's even more. Who's got a Naive Bayes classifier programmed in there? Well, I found one. There's a package which is strangely called E1071. It was apparently named that because the people at the University of Vienna, computer science, who developed it, live on some hallway in a building that is designated as E1071. So, talk about inside references, right? When they have a function, it's called, if you can see it here, it's called, can I zoom? No, I can't zoom. It's called Naive Bayes. And you give it your X matrix, you give your labels, and you give it a smoothing parameter, and then you fit it, and then you can then say, predict it for me. Well, what it did was it predicted that the British National Party is anti-immigration. But I told it that because that was one of my training examples. I also told it that on the right of this was the Ninth Party, which was the UKIP. So I said UKIP and the British National Party, those were the training examples. And it not only failed to recover that I told it that the anti-immigrant UKIP was anti-immigrant, it didn't even predict that on its own training example. There's something badly wrong here. Well, what's wrong with it? It's not that they made a mistake. It's a different model. It uses a Gaussian response. Text does not have a Gaussian response. It has a multinomial structure. It's a different distribution for the function. So if you were to just off the shelf say, oh, some smart people have programmed this, and this package has been around for 10 plus years, let's use that. Wrong model. Get the wrong results. Well, of course, I've written a function for this. Have we stopped working? No. So I've got a function I wrote in Quantita called textModel_MB for naive Bayes. And if you run that, we end up getting these scientific notation probabilities. We correctly recover the British National Party. We correctly recover UKIP. And then we get some nuances in between that make sense. So I didn't trust that their implementation was correct. My use of it verified that. I then read their source code, and I figured out exactly what they were doing. And I knew that that was the wrong model. And then I rewrote this myself. And in doing so, I made two or three mistakes that after the code was posted, other people alerted me to, which I corrected. I implemented tests. So 90% of the massive amount of code in this package is subject to unit tests. And you know, when I say don't trust myself, I didn't trust them. I re-implemented it. And then I didn't trust myself, and people pointed out to me the mistakes. But by now, I have a high degree of trust in it because it's been subject to that same scrutiny where people know exactly what it's doing, people smarter than I, who've been able to test it and verify that it's working. And if it's not working, you hear from people pretty quickly. This is one of the reasons to trust open source over closed programs. And I can remember these debates. You don't hear about this so much anymore because so much in machine learning is open source, even when it's written by Google. 10 years ago or 15 years ago, this debate over should we use R, should we teach using a program like Stata? And the argument was, well, let's use Stata because that's made by a company and we trust the company because we have to pay for it, therefore it must be right. And I know the people at Stata and I think that they are right. They're very, very good. I do trust Stata. But just because it's closed, you know, you can't see their source code. You don't know if what they've done is right. You're trusting them. With open source, you don't have to trust anyone. You can verify it yourself. You trust your own eyes. Number five is you want to work cooperatively with others. I say compete with yourself. So strive for excellence. But this activity of data science in today's world is very much a cooperative activity. And I say this because the tools on which I've been working now for 6 years in the Quantita package, they're built on tools that other people have developed. And people have built their tools on Quantita. So I have a lot of packages that use mine as dependencies in order to build on top of that. And when the way that the R infrastructure works, for example, when I update my package, I have to make a check that anyone else who's using it, I haven't broken anything that they're doing, because that's the nature of the archive, that they have a very strict set of controls to make sure that this cooperative working together is something that works. And let me show you some of the goals that we designed the tools to meet. So one of them is to make common goods, not particularistic benefits. This is actually something that I really encourage people to think about, especially in the field of methodology. Methodology is about testing, developing, and I think disseminating tools. A tool is only going to help people if they have access to it. And a tool is only going to help people if they can use it, and hopefully that it's pleasant enough that they want to use it. But let's say that you solve a really cool problem in your work, and you do that using a tool that you've developed. What a wonderful thing, not just for you, but also for yourself, if you can make a common good from that by developing a tool that's also something other people can use. Now, not everyone is going to go to the extreme that I've gone to, which is to make tools that now get downloaded, I don't know, 15,000 times per month. you know, in the total sets of tools that we've developed that I'll show you at the end of the talk, with probably approaching 500,000 downloads, that's one extreme. But in general, if the tool is good enough for other people to use, it's going to be good enough for your purpose. It's not the other way around. There's a big difference between hacking out some code that solves your problem and making that code general and robust enough that other people can use it. But if you go to that step, you've got a nice, you've built something nice. I say that it's good to do what you can do best and let others do the same. So there are many things that you can do with text analytic constructs that I have not re-implemented. I re-implemented Naive Bayes because I didn't like the way that it was out there, and I wanted a very specific version for text that worked with my framework. But let's say topic models. I don't have code in Quantita that fits topic models, but I have code that makes it work very well. This STM package, or the topic models package, I have code that makes it very easy to do everything you want in Quantita and then hand off the object to those packages and let them do their work. Let them do their thing, because there's a lot of expertise behind that, that these people who wrote it know a lot more about that than I do. And I don't want to replace what they've done. I want to make my tool work with theirs. And if you can make things work with one another, this interoperability, then you can have the proper division of expertise and labor to create a world full of useful tools for everyone. Text-to-Vec is another one. This fits word embedding models. And our object actually prepares the inputs better than their package prepares the inputs, but then they fit the model better than we do because we don't do it at all. We're not the only text analysis tool available in R. So I know if you're not an R user or a Quantita user, you're not aware of this ecosystem. But let's say that we have developed a program like Stata, and there are other people out there who've developed things like SPSS or, you know, any of the packages economists use, eViews or whatever, TSP. You know, why would you think, okay, I'm going to develop a new library for text analysis if there's several out there already? Well, we want to do is, we want to implement our vision in a particular way, and others, like the TidyText package, is an extension of this R dialect known as the Tidyverse, and you could use that, it's a perfectly good package, but they don't do everything that we do. And I've written some of the code for TidyText. I'm actually listed as one of the contributors in their authorship list for TidyText because I wanted to make our package work with theirs. Even though they're really a competitor package, there's no reason we couldn't make it so that people can go in back and forth as seamlessly as possible. And the other thing is, when I can develop a tool that works outside of my core framework, I will spin it off into a package in such a way that it doesn't depend on the core framework. How many of you do NLP in Python? Anyone? Have you heard of the Spacey package? You should check it out. It's awesome. Developed by two people in Berlin, and it does natural language processing tasks like part-of-speech tagging, dependency parsing, and some advanced entity recognition and things like that. It's written in Python. We thought, wow, what a wonderful tool. We're not going to possibly re-implement that in R, but we want to give people access to that through R. So with Aki Matsuo, we wrote a package called SpaceyR that basically is a gateway to the Python world, but through R. And then we wrote that to work perfectly seamlessly with Quantita, but we also wrote it in a way that if you're not a Quantita user, then you can use this as well. If you're an R user and you want access to Spacey, here's your package. And we wrote that in a way that would benefit people more than trying to lock them into using just Quantita. And that actually gets a lot of usage. Here's an example. So here I'm running this. I've got some input text, and I run Spacey parse. Well, it produces the tokens, the limits of the tokens, a part of speech tag, so it knows that the word universal is an adjective, or that the word supplement is a noun. And it also can recognize entities, like year is a date entity. It's not the best example, but this is the information that's returned by Spacey parse. Number 6. Making mistakes is good. I believe this, because the more mistakes you make in the past, the less you have to make in the future, as long as you fix and learn from your mistakes. And one of the nice things about the tools for disseminating software in these days You have an absolute complete record of all the contributions, of all the code fixes, of all the issues, and everything that's ever been done to your code. If you use tools that are designed to foster open source, like GitHub. Anyone use GitHub? Okay, so if there's anything that transformed my world, in the professional sense, I should say, more fundamentally than anything else, it's got to be GitHub. So if you don't know what GitHub is, you have a world of discovery awaiting you. It's like, you know, discovering physics or something. I don't know what it's like. It's the most amazing tool possible. It's the platform where we host all of our code, all of our issues, all of our reviews of our code, all of the complete record of every contribution to the code, where anything can be scrutinized or browsed, and all you need is a web browser for it. It's absolutely amazing. It's where we disseminate all of the open source projects, and we're the biggest open source code source in the entire universe, in the world, as we know it anyway. So I'm going to give you a tale of how this is about making mistakes, and, you know, just because you made a mistake before doesn't mean you have to be committed to it. I'll just give you an idea. There's a rival package. This is a package called TM for text mining. And it's been around for like 15, 16, 17 years. And people wondered when we started this, well, why would you do this? You just use TM. TM's got millions of downloads. Quantite is much better. Anyone who's used both will tell you Quantite is better. I think the guys who wrote TM now would admit that it's better. And I know maybe they wouldn't admit that publicly, but privately, at least one of them has. Anyway, stop word list. A stop word list is a list of common words that you would want to take out of your text because you're not interested in them. The most common word in the English language is the word V. If you're doing a word cloud and you want to see the most common words in a text and you plot it without filtering, guess what you'll get? You'll get a giant word V in the middle of your cloud. It's not really that interesting. You're not interested, you know, you don't think that the word V necessarily has some informative social content that you want to analyze. So this is one of the words in a list of things you get rid of. Well, we built a function into our package called stop words. You type stop words, you give it the name of the language, and then you get your list of stop words. You can change the list, you can add to it, you can do whatever you want with it, but it's sort of a recommended list. And we used to tell people, when they called the function, there used to be a little warning saying, don't assume that there's a universal stop word list, that, you know, this is just a recommended list, but you're responsible for your stop words. If that got to be so annoying, we removed the warning. But when you look at the list of standard stop words, like the standard stop words, of which there is none, the future tense of the verb to be in English is a word called will. Well, will means many different things. It can mean the human determination, you know, the will to succeed. It can mean a legal document of what happens to all that stuff in your garage when you die. You know, do you give it to your kids? Do you give it to charity? Does it, you know, whatever. It can also, of course, mean the future tense of the verb to be, which is its overwhelmingly most common usage. And we thought, well, we shouldn't take that word out. So we took it out of the stop word list. And then every time we plotted a word cloud, the biggest word was always the word will. And we were having to then remove it separately. So if you look at the difference between our stop words function and then the TM package, after we'd already created ours, they copied us and they created a function called stop words. And they took our data from our package and included it in theirs. But they took it before we replaced the word will. Because like after 2 years of not having the word will, we put the word will back. Well, their package still has the early version where the word will was removed. So they're distributed more than we are still. They took out the word will from their stop word list. Every user of that is using a stop word list that removed a word that I, in a personal decision sitting in my office one day, decided to take out of the stop word list, even though the authoritative source on the ultimate source of all things true called the internet had the word will in the stop word list. I took that out, and then for the 2 years in which they copied me, they copied that, and they also had it taken out. And when I realized my mistake, I corrected it, I put it back, as according to the internet source. The original is more than the internet source, but and they didn't. So they copied my mistake because they weren't paying attention or something like that, even though I've written to them saying, hey guys, you know, I think you should put this back in. Well, I now have split that off, and I have an entire package called stock words. So we have a whole package. If I click on this, I'll show you what it looks like. So this basically takes you to the GitHub page, which is also the source page. Well, this is what the package looks like. This gets downloaded 21,000 times a month. Since we created it, it's got almost 200,000 downloads. And all this package does is provide stock words. So we took this out of our package, and we said, you know what, so many people are using this, and after this tale of what's happening, let's create a standalone package just to provide stop words. And this is the GitHub page I was saying, so this is the information for it, and it's got a little demonstration, and then it's got a table of all of the languages in there, and it's got everything. Well, not everything, it's got a lot. It doesn't have Maori, but, you know, it's got, I don't know, Marathi and Persian and Southern Sotho and Tagalog and Yoruba. So there's a lot of different languages in there. And every contribution to this code and every revision of this code and everything that's ever been done with it is visible through that page, which I think is really cool. Okay. Let's see. I'll get back to that. And then here's another good illustration. So one of the ways that we analyze things in text analysis is through the use of dictionaries. A dictionary approach is to say, I've got a set of words that I'm going to associate with positive sentiment, my happy words. I've got words that are negative words. You use this a lot in analyzing product reviews. You crank through the text that you have through a set of dictionaries, and all the matches to positive words you count, all the matches to negative words you count, and you get like how many times were there positive words, how many times were there negative words. Well, I applied this to the debates, the political debates from the Irish Parliament, that was my example earlier, using a very standard dictionary published by Stuart Soroka and Laura Young called the Lexicoder Sentiment Dictionary. It's got a lot of sites. It's published, it's got a website, it's got a copyright, you know, it's a very widely used dictionary. Well, they put in something into the dictionary that is a wild card match. You can't really see it here, but I-R-E star. There are two words in the English language that match this pattern that I could find. Ire, which means anger, and I think it's ireful or iresome. It's one of those two. If you're full of anger or full of ire. So they could have just put in those two words for fixed match, but they put it in with a wild card. When you run this example through the Irish ones, so if you want to see what are the pattern matches, these are all the ones that they have for ire. So there's ire star, there's also hellfire, barbed wire, crossfire. They just put a star up at the end. Not really a good idea with Ireland, because when you match this pattern, not a single usage of the somewhat odd word ire comes up, but a lot of matches to the country's name Ireland come up. Who is using the usage of Ireland more? Well, the government, this is some code we don't have to go through, but basically this is a plot I produced with my package using this code, and if you sort of zoom in on that, which you can't really do, but let's say that you look at the person. So this is, there are two dots on each line. There's a speaker here. The blue dot is when you take out that pattern match for I or star, and the red one is when you put it in there for with, and you look at the amount of negativity they had. Well, it was the finance minister who has the biggest difference in seeming a lot more negative when you use their mistaken dictionary, and the other person is the prime minister, Brian Cowan, who also seemed a lot more negative than he otherwise would. Why? Because these are the government people presenting the budget, and they're talking about the state of our country, Ireland, the Irish banks, and other things like that. So this is a mistake that yields substantive results that are associated with a particular partition of the corpus being government or opposition. And the moral of this story is, be careful when you just take things off the shelf and assume that they're right. Be careful if you use someone else's stop word list. Be careful if you use their dictionary. It may not be one size fits all. Number 7. What is the hardest thing about quantitative text analysis? Getting your text into the computer. It's really, really hard. Anyone can run 2 or 3 lines of code once their texts are nice and clean and put into the computer. Until you got to that step, you're going to be pulling your hair out and chasing people down and say, I've got Microsoft Word 1997 format. I've got this weird Cyrillic encoding, some antiquated 8-bit format. I've got something in Hindi. I have no idea what encoding that's in. Then I've got these PDFs from weird formats. I've got PDFs that have text, and I've got PDFs that don't have text. When I convert them, I get a mixture of text and gobbledygook. Right? How do I get rid of all this stuff? Well, one solution is take a massive research budget and take some graduate students and tell them that their summer is finished. Life is over. For the next 3 months, you will clean my text. Of course, you can also do this through, it's not crowdsourcing, but E-Lancing. Not even Mechanical Turk. It's where you actually hire an expert who lives in some country where they exist on nothing but a handful of rice and, you know, some slave wages, and they do this work. It sounds really bad, but there are people, like, you can get people to do jobs in the Philippines who are absolute geniuses. They're experts. They do it in a few hours, and they charge you, I don't know, $50-$60, and they're happy and you're happy. You can get people to do that, so you don't have to ruin the lives of your PhD students. I've done that too. So the hardest task is doing this. But what if you want to do this yourself? What tools are there besides a lot of absolutely manual labor that requires also usually a high degree of expertise, like a really high degree of expertise? Well, our solution, of course, with the particularistic benefits versus common goods, is to create a common good. We've got a package called ReadText. And ReadText does one thing. It reads your text in and does all the conversion. And it's smart enough to basically do this automatically. And this is a package which really hasn't taken off yet. Everyone who discovers it says, this is brilliant. You know, I wish I'd known about this before. Not sure why it hasn't taken off as much yet, but that's basically what it does. It solves this problem. It attempts to solve this problem. Number 8, I think design is really important. Design, what is design? Well, if you've ever used a computer library that someone else has written, sometimes they can be terrible, right? You spend all this time learning, it's like learning a different dialect or even a different language for every project. Why should you have to do that? And R is one of the worst offenders in this, but Python's not much better. So architecture is a mixture of design and engineering. And here I've shown like 2 examples that are both really cool for both design and engineering that are architectural. Wonder if this is a Sydney Harbour Opera House. I'm not sure what that one is. We designed the function names using a grammar that was logically consistent for Quantita. And I don't know how many of you can see this or how well you can see it, but there are a set of core object types, and the core object types have names that construct the object, and then we have a set of functions that take the object in and modify it and return the same object type. And it's super consistent. So the naming is very consistent. The arguments are consistent. We spend a huge amount of time, every time someone, we talk about changing a feature, we spend a huge amount of time designing the change in a way that will ensure consistency with the existing functions. And there is the more complicated the package becomes, the more important this is. So I won't belabor this point. You know, if you want to look through the slides later or look through the help pages for this package, people who really appreciate R, who learn this, will tell me that, you know, oh, I love the way you've designed this. It's really consistent. It's really easy to keep in mind the names of the things. That's important, I think. If you're not an experienced R user and use it for the first time, you'll be a bit spoiled because it'll be easier to learn than your typical R package. Typical R package is you start with something small, you start adding stuff, you think, hey, we need a name for, you know, let's get a function that'll do selection of tokens based on the pattern. Well, what would we call that function? Well, let's call it selection, capital, select, capital, tokens, capital, on a pattern. Right? Yeah, that makes sense. And then you have this help index, which consists of 150 functions that have no logical organization or order or consistency, and it grows incrementally into a giant mess. Like an academic's office, kind of. Well, we didn't want the academic's office. We wanted a nice, clean desk that it was logical to figure out where everything was. We have functions for here. I'm showing you functions for document feature matrix functions, functions for statistics. Every function that computes a statistic based on an input starts with text stat underscore. So if you looked at the index of functions, they would all be under text stat. Everything that computes a text model is under text model underscore. Everything that computes a plot is text plot underscore. So these are really nicely organized. And we don't have any, they're almost, every time we find an exception, we say, no, that's not something we're going to accept. Two more points, and then we'll have questions in wine. Number 9, and this is really important. Why would anyone do this? And maybe it's not aware to you just how much goes into this, but I spent time this morning when I really should have been doing other things, working on a review for my Japanese co-author, Kohei, who spent an enormous amount of time in the last 2 months redesigning the corpus object structure, and I was dealing with the code on that. I did some programming yesterday. Why would I spend so much time on this? Why have I spent so much time on this, more than any other thing I've spent time on over the last 4 or 5 years, putting time into this effort? Well, I can do it because I have that thing called tenure. In fact, I can't even be promoted anymore. So for me, yeah, I can get away with it. But how do we reward people who might be interested in contributing to projects like this? It's all great for me to stand up here and say, you know, collective goods, you know, we should try to design tools that other people can use. But what reward do you have for that? So if you're a student, you know, you've got to finish your dissertation. You don't have time for that. And if you spend a lot of time with that, hopefully your supervisor will say, hey, you know, do this after you finish your thesis, right? Because, you know, this is the 11th year of your PhD program right now, and we've got to get things moving on. If you're an assistant professor that you're looking for a promotion or trying to get tenure or whatever the equivalent of assistant professor is here or in your own system, you know, you've got to worry about promotion, you've got to worry about tenure. You can't spend too much time on these things if there's no recognition. And I think that this is one of the issues that we have to confront. So, you know, when you say publishing in top-ranked journals, if I click on this to show you what I mean, here are some top-ranked journals, you know, in political science anyway, you should be trying to publish in these journals. The American Journal of Political Science, the American Political Science Review, these are the targets that you need to hit for promotion. And any tenure committee in the United States, or most tenure committees in other systems, will tell you, you know, some of them even have a formula. You need 5 in the top 5. You need 5 articles in the top 5, and that's what we consider for tenure. Not everyone is that brutalist, but that's not an uncommon thing to hear. What about citations? I'm not choosing myself. This is a colleague of mine, Simon Hicks. I can pick on Simon as much as I want because he's a named chair. He has 20,000 citations, which is more than twice as many as I have. And he's written some amazing work. He's a great guy, a friend of mine. If you look at these citations, this is currency. So if anyone wants to quickly Google you and figure out how serious is this guy, 20,000 Google sites, like, okay, yeah, that's hardcore, right? We recognize that. But, you know, what about going back to what I showed you before on the downloads? What about software downloads? I got 500,000 downloads. How does that stack up against 20,000 Google sites? In academia, we don't have any way to measure downloads of open source software. In fact, it's like it doesn't even have a currency value. It's like, you know, going to the World Bank and talking about Bitcoin. They're like, yeah, we know there's Bitcoin, but we don't have a conversion for that. We don't accept that. What about people using your data set? What if you have a data set that you really package up nicely and people are downloading and using that? What about, you know, on this thing called GitHub? So on GitHub here, this is the organization page for something I'll talk about in my last point. These are our 4 packages. So I've got 458 stars on GitHub. for Quantita. That means these many people are following it. I've got 110 people have forked it. So they made a complete clone of the open source software, either to modify it for their own purposes or something else. That's a lot, right? And if we click on, you know, if we click on this and we look at some of the badges for downloads, you know, it's got 226,000 as of today. It's got its own document object identifier. How do we convert that into something that can gain recognition? You know, that's a challenge that we need to solve. There's also this thing called Stack Overflow. Anyone use Stack Overflow? I mean, I've got a question I just must have just answered because for some reason it was open. No, it's gone now. But anyway, I answer these questions. What about those? You're sharing your expertise. That's really valuable to a community. We have a very narrow view of what is activity to the community that should be rewarded in academia, and that's got to change. I think that the credit giving in academic research is too traditional, and the people who have the skills to contribute to the activity that we need in the contemporary world is not always associated with reward in the traditional academic structures. And I say this all the time because I see super smart, super skilled people who can do this sort of work who don't make it through the hiring or the promotion process, and they just leave and go work for Facebook. And it's so frustrating to see that sort of talent loss in academia, where people are just saying, well, why haven't you published in the American Sociological Review lately or whatever? Here's an example. So we went over this morning to I thought there should be like a shrine. I wanted to light a candle or, you know, like Jimi Hendrix's grave or something like that. You know, I went over to where Ross Ahaka's office was in the statistics computer science department. There's a lot of cool old models of old computers, half of which I used to own one of. And there's these things I took, you know, a picture of on the desk. But this is one of the places where R was developed. I think that's absolutely amazing. You know, this guy should basically be, you know, be given a whatever queen's honor, or, you know, made Sir Ross or something like that for this incredible contribution. This is where R was developed in 1995, along with a guy named Robert Gentleman. And yeah, there's very little there except for sort of a note which says this was his office. I think that's fantastic. And then you look at his Google sites. He's got 10,000 for R, and just, you know, maybe 1,000 for everything else combined. And he retired as an associate professor. And you think, well, you know, did people fully appreciate his contribution? I don't know if they did. So I've developed what we have this impact agenda in the United Kingdom, where our research gets assessed every 7 or 8 years. Not just for scholarly impact, but also for public impact. And I thought, well, how could I turn this academic geeky project of mine into public impact? We created something called the Quantita Initiative. What is this? This is something I haven't heard of any other academic doing. We turned our research project into a nonprofit, it's a private organization, but it's nonprofit. It's called a community interest company. Its objective is to produce goods for the community of open source analytic software specifically related to text analysis. This is our logo. We have this alternative thing if you're a fan of Lost, second TV reference here, like the Derma Initiative. And we created this organization where, you know, if you want to see where our website, quantita.org, and it's got information, including, very importantly, I really should have done a shout-out to my team here. So Kohei is the Chief Technology Officer and co-director, and Aki as well as my co-author on the SpaceER. And they've done some amazing stuff with this. And this gives them some official recognition and a way to motivate them. We've been doing training events. So I get asked like once every few weeks if I'll go do a training session on the software. And now we actually say, yes, we will, but we will send you a bill. You know, let's not talk about honorarium or payment or whatever. With the Quantita Initiative, you could pay the Quantita Initiative and we recover our costs and take care of it and channel it through that. And we're going to use this as a vehicle for dissemination and training. We're getting the blog going. If you look at the blog, I think there's actually an entry for, that's under news. There we go. There's a little reference with some links to this seminar, for example, and a symposium that COA is organizing, September, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's a way of creating something that will be more lasting and more general that other people can participate in, and that can attract funding and organize activities, a bit of official status. And it'll be interesting to see how well that works. And the last thing is, a project is only as good as how much you disseminate it, I think. So we've tried to disseminate this as much as possible. So there are a number of websites, and I'll make sure that you have access to this later, but there's the website I already showed you for the Quantita Initiative, and then there's a lot of more information about our projects and the different packages that we support with links. We have a tutorial website. Oh, I don't know what's happened there. I know we're working on a revision of that, but that shouldn't be down. There is a text blog. There is an entire channel on Stack Overflow for Quantita, where I answer most of the questions. We have talks like this. And this is what I'm working on with Kohei over the next 4 months, when I'll be a visitor at the Australian National University. I'll be working on a book about this, probably one of those O'Reilly books with some animal on it. I'll try to get a weka or something cool on there. Something kind of New Zealand-y. You've got the best, coolest birds and the nicest animals. Every animal we've encountered in New Zealand is nice, except for the sandfly. That's not nice. Everyone else, the rest of them are really nice. That's not true in Australia. Just stay away from some of those. So, dissemination is really important. If you've got something, you want to make it usable by teaching people how to use it and giving talks and tutorials and websites and that sort of thing. And this, once again, takes a lot of activity that might not be properly rewarded, but that's a shame. We don't want to deter people from doing that because, whoever that user base is of 229,000 downloads, there are people out there who are using this package a lot, and they're able to do things through research that they weren't able to do before. So to wrap up this talk, it went from a journey where I developed some tools for my own research purposes, and then I started disseminating them to friends, and then I started developing an open source project, and now we've got an entire nonprofit organization based around this, and I'm literally traveling the world giving talks about it and planning a book and other forms of dissemination. Not every academic project will yield this sort of thing, but when you can, and when there's a need that you can meet that way, I think it's a great thing, and I hope that not just that people appreciate it, but I hope that we can build some structure into our academic framework that gives people, especially more junior people, the reward that would be necessary for making this a core part of careers. Thank you very much.
Questions? I'm happy to stay around for questions. Yes.